Tuesday morning to you, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon Podcast. Since it is Tuesday, this is an archive show, first published as a newspaper column and podcast episode several years ago. Thanks for downloading, and I sure hope you enjoy it. This story was first published on July 3rd of 2016 under the headline, In Trial, Top Suspect Became Star Witness Against Innocent Man. Here we go. On April 22, 1943, a jury of Albany-area housewives, mill workers, and farmers brought back a verdict against the strange, well-dressed black man who stood facing them. It was guilty. The verdict brought to an end a trial that had been so laden with stereotypes and literary tropes that the Sunday magazine American Weekly, the following month, recapped the whole affair with a dramatic package headlined, Actual Crime with All the Settings of Fiction. It laid out, in sensationalistic prose with lurid illustrations, the official storyline. Murderer Robert E. Lee Folks, a cook in the train's dining car, having spent the entire evening shirking his job duties and drinking cheap liquor and making boorish passes at random white maidens and now afire with carnal lust, tiptoes into the Pullman coach, planning to rape the lovely young Martha James at knife point. When she awakens and screams, he cuts her throat to silence her, then leaps out of the berth and races back to the kitchen, where he stations himself over a cold stove and pretends he's been cooking eggs on it the whole time. Meanwhile, a brave and noble U.S. Marine has heard the scream and is racing to her rescue. Alas, too late to do anything but help penetrate the murderer's defenses, break his alibi, and see that justice is served. Left unmentioned in the American Weekly account were a couple of other literary tropes that the trial fitted so well. It was every bit as race-baity as the 1915 movie Birth of a Nation, depicting black man as a bestial creature with an uncontrolled lust ever yearning to, quote, defile the daughters of middle-class white people. And in other ways, it was almost a straight rip-off of the railroad train variant of the classic locked room mystery, like Murder on the Orient Express by Agatha Christie. And according to Western Oregon University professor Max G. Geyer's book about the case, that similarity to familiar literary tropes was not an accident. Also left out of the story are a wide range of inconvenient facts that make folks' guilt almost impossible to believe in, chief among which are the fingernail clipping samples that were taken and tested after the murder and revealed traces of nothing but starch, grease, flour, and baking soda. Absolutely no blood. Geyer makes a powerful case that Folks was a scapegoat, a target of opportunity seized upon to solve a very specific set of problems faced by nearly everyone in a position of authority that day. To win a conviction against him, prosecutors tried, successfully, to distract from the lack of actual evidence by manipulating their story to make it as familiar as possible and appealing to the prejudices that had made Birth of a Nation such a popular movie in those dark, pre-war years of nationwide Jim Crowism. In fairness to those jurors, this probably wouldn't have worked on its own. But in combination with a confession that had almost certainly been either fabricated or beaten out of Folks during a 3-day interrogation session with Los Angeles Police Department officers at the city jail, it was more than enough. One of the most striking things about this case is how overwhelming was the evidence against that Marine who claimed to have come too late to Martha James' rescue, Private Harold Wilson. Wilson, it turned out, had been released from the brig the day he boarded the train in Washington. He'd been locked up there for an alleged sexual assault. His commanding officer was sending him to a combat unit in the same way that misbehaving German soldiers were sent to the Eastern Front. He might very well have been thinking this train trip would be his last few hours of freedom. And the witnesses' accounts dovetail perfectly with an attempted sexual assault at knife point gone wrong. Each remembers the words slightly differently, but most agree that it started with a woman saying, I can't stand this any longer, followed by, he's killing me, and a horrible scream. Sleep-fogged passengers poke their heads out of the curtains to see Wilson already bending over the still-bleeding body. Then one of the passengers pulled the cord to summon the steward, and it was only after that bell rang that Wilson started shouting that murder had been done. Wilson's story started out sketchy and changed almost every time he retold it. First, he claimed to have run to the end of the train in pursuit of the killer and seen no one. Then, when a train man replied that he had to have seen at the very least a cook and a waiter and a steward, he changed his story to include all three of those characters. He miscounted the number of cars he ran through and then said he hadn't maybe made it to the end of the train after all, although one source says a blood trail was found leading to the end of the train. He claimed that it took him 9 steps to get to the end of the car in pursuit, and he was less than 6 feet from the end of the car. On the witness stand, he was unable even to identify his military unit, and one of the witnesses recalls him actually trying to plant a bloody towel in the bathroom between the murder scene and the cook's car. But in court, the prosecution seemed to fight desperately to avoid even considering the possibility that Wilson had any role in the murder other than that of too late would-be rescuer. The railroad ordered its employees not to cooperate with Folk's defense attorney, and the prosecution even constructed, in an Albany railroad yard, a life-size diorama of the murder train, except that it had been modified so that the cook's car, in which Folk's was working, was one car away from the murder car instead of 5 or 6. So why turn a blind eye to such a promising suspect and focus all energy on pinning the job on a man with a pretty decent alibi, against whom the only evidence is guesswork, tainted and shifting testimony from Wilson, and an unsigned and probably coerced confession extracted from him by what was then one of the most notoriously brutal police departments in the country? The most likely answer is that for every authority involved, Folk's conviction represented salvation from consequences ranging from inconvenience to catastrophe. We'll talk about those consequences in next week's column. Key sources in this column have included works by Max Geyer, Neil Barker, and the archives of the Portland Morning Oregonian. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. More info is at our hub page at offbeatoregon.com. Offbeat Oregon is a division of Pulplit Productions, a boutique publishing house about which more can be learned at pulp-lit.com. Speaking of which, if you enjoy listening to me, you might check out some of my audiobooks. You can find them most easily with a search for my name on audible.com. Most of them are old pulp stuff, H.P. Lovecraft, Edgar Rice Burroughs, etc., but at least two of them are Offbeat Oregon history type stuff. Check them out if you're so inclined. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Questions, critiques, ideas for a future episode? Email me at fj@offbeatoregon.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.